This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Since Governor Evers announced he would be extending his Safer at Home order, there's been a lot of pushback. There have been some small-scale protests in cities like Brookfield and Madison. Some Wisconsin sheriffs have come out in opposition of the order. And yesterday, the Republican-led legislature filed legal action against the order. At the heart of this fight, like the fight over the April election, is really this simple question. Who has the power to do what? Who's in charge? It might be a simple question, but as Philip Rocco will tell you, there isn't a simple answer. Rocco is an assistant professor at Marquette University, where he teaches courses on American politics and the policymaking process. He joins me now from his home. Philip Rocco, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Great to be with you, Joy.
So this is a situation that's pretty unprecedented in modern history. So from the beginning, there have been a lot of open questions about who's in charge and what they can do. The question I had when really all of this really started to culminate was, how did we prepare for a situation like this? Had we prepared, our government, had it prepared for a situation like the one we're currently confronted with?
Yeah, well, one way of thinking about it is that really from the founding, we've given state governments and local governments power to do things that are necessary to protect public health. That's why when the 10th Amendment reserves what are effectively called police powers to the states, things like quarantine laws, for example, you know, have a very, very long history. In fact, really even one of the first, you know, major sort of defining constitutional cases in the Supreme Court, Gibbons versus Ogden, I think it mentions even quarantine laws as something that's sort of definitively within the power of state governments. Now, obviously, things have changed a lot since, you know, the early 19th century, and there was a sort of wave of revisions to state emergency preparedness laws sort of after 9/11. And the major thing, you know, to note about what state governments have the capacity to do is that they have the capacity to sort of respond in a comprehensive way to manage public health emergencies, especially emergencies related to infectious diseases when they arise. And so that's why, you know, when Governor Evers puts out a safer at home order, he's not just sort of coming up with his authority to do that on the fly. That authority rests in a chapter of Wisconsin state statutes called Chapter 252. And that just sort of explicitly is like a playbook for how the state should respond when a public health emergency arises.
Well, and that gets to a big question, I think. There's been this overriding question about whether or not Governor Evers really has the power to do anything by himself. When he wanted to postpone the election, he was told he didn't have the power to do that. Now that he wants to keep the stay-at-home order in place, you know, there are some who are saying that he doesn't have the power to do that, although he obviously did have the power to create the initial stay-at-home order. What kind of emergency powers does the governor have at the moment?
The thing that I'll note here is that because the governor's public health emergency powers are very large, they're extensive, and you know, I would encourage listeners, you know, if you're interested or bored, you have some time at home, go and look at Chapter 252 of the state statutes. It gives the governor a pretty substantial amount of power to create emergency rules when something like COVID-19 arises. Now, obviously, there's a sort of political battle in the country that's going on about, you know, are these emergency measures too extensive? Are they too draconian? Now, the battle is going on not in public opinion. Public opinion is at present vastly in support of maintaining these sorts of measures, keeping businesses and schools closed as this crisis goes on. I think in Wisconsin, the Marquette poll has public support for that at around 86%, whereas I think about 10% of respondents think that the governor has gone too far. Rather, the conflict is between sort of the president's party, Republicans, and Democrats. So I think the challenge now is that Republicans are trying to find ways of creating more political support where it doesn't exist to push for sort of economic reopening beyond what public health officials see as sort of advisable at this point in time. And so what we're seeing in Wisconsin is that that battle is playing out not through the legislature trying to pass a new law that says it has the authority to do something, but actually using the Supreme Court and challenging the governor's authority, which again is pretty clearly prescribed within state statutes, but they're trying to challenge that in court rather than trying to actually sort of make the public and political case that the order has gone too far.
Yeah, so they're trying to contest it through the courts. Of course, they just did this with the decision to postpone, or rather not postpone, the election. If they're successful, what would that mean for the office of the governor here in Wisconsin, but potentially nationally?
I think if Republicans are successful challenging this at the court, it would have pretty broad implications for what the governor could do under a variety of emergency scenarios, which I think is kind of distressing, especially given that the revision of many state statutes happened sort of after 9/11 in response to the possibility of bioterrorism. I mean, I think that depending on, you know, how the court rules, if it rules in favor of Republicans in this case, which I think hasn't even been briefed yet or filed, I think it could have major implications for what the governor can do in a situation like this. Beyond the state of Wisconsin, I think it's sort of important to consider that when states sort of open up their economies in a situation where they're not able to sufficiently control, test or do contact tracing for the virus, it creates feedback effects for other states. Obviously, states are sort of interconnected and people go across state lines, and that could have ramifications beyond the state of Wisconsin itself.
Well, and that gets to another question. Where does the buck stop ultimately? What is the chain of command in this situation? Is the governor, you know, the final wall there, or who's in charge?
Well, I mean, let me try to answer that question in two ways. As far as the law goes, in an emergency scenario like this, and it varies a little bit from state to state, but in general, the governor is really where the buck stops. The executive branch has extensive authority in emergency scenarios. And again, this is like really clearly spelled out in black letter law in the Wisconsin state statutes, for example. However, authority and power are two different things. Just because the Constitution gives the governor the power to do something, it doesn't necessarily mean that the politics of the scenario are going to allow that to be the final action. And I think that what we're seeing right now is that Republicans in the state of Wisconsin are in a place where they, number one, don't have the authority to do what they want to do. They don't necessarily have the political support statewide to do that either. And so I think what they're trying to do here is create a set of scenarios that changes the political dynamic, that actually puts them in a better position politically. One, by sort of taking the decision to a venue which they know has been very friendly to them in the past. If you think about the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, it is, with very few exceptions, pretty reliably friendly to the demands of the Republican state legislature. And there's still a balance of power on the court, despite the results of the April 7th election, that advantages Republicans there. Additionally, I think that Republicans are trying to change the dynamic of hearts and minds. There have been these protests in Madison, for example, and they really haven't included that many people. It doesn't really represent a large number of people who are, you know, willing to go out there and do that kind of work, nor does it really represent anything more than a very, very small sliver of public opinion. However, the hope is that, I think, by getting a lot of coverage on those people, they sort of amplify the idea that this is really a divisive partisan issue rather than one on which most people, in fact, agree that it would be better to have the public health situation under control before any sort of major resumption of any kind of normal economic activity commences. I think what this entire debate is so sort of focused on the politics of the governor's emergency order that it leaves out these bigger questions about resources, the resources the state needs to actually do the kind of testing and contact tracing necessary to reopen the economy. And I think that by really making this about this one issue, the governor's authority to use his powers of emergency management, it really leaves out what public health officials around the state and around the country know is a really, really important criterion to get states where they need to be.
Yeah, there's been a conversation, of course, right now about whether or not Election Day had a big impact on spreading the coronavirus. But of course, we don't have widespread testing, even for people who have symptoms. If they're still mild, if they don't have to be hospitalized for them, they won't be tested. So it's we're having this conversation without having the facts a lot of the time.
Right. And I think this is why the really sort of unfortunate thing about this is that by framing the issue as a contest between do you reopen the economy or do you keep it closed, we're missing a really important dimension of the entire puzzle, which is there are things that the federal government needs to do to give states the capacity to open again. Many of the measures that are included in the White House guidelines for reopening really hinge on this question of, are there adequate testing capacities? Are we able to do the kind of contact tracing that allows us to know whether or not we've had a true decline in the rate of cases? Because, of course, many people are, in fact, asymptomatic carriers. And so I think that it's really sort of important not to lose sight of the fact that this is really a multidimensional problem. And when we start focusing on one dimension, we really lose our ability to see a fuller picture of the puzzle.
Yeah. So to take a kind of step back, you know, we're talking about the stay-at-home order, and with that comes some idea of enforcement. Right now, how are they enforcing this order?
Right. So that's a really good question. And the thing that I'll know, I'll just start with the law. Wisconsin State Statute Chapter 252.25, which says that any person who willfully violates or obstructs the orders related to public health shall be imprisoned for not more than 30 days or fined not more than $500 or both. Now, obviously, this is something that in practice can be very, very difficult to implement. And in many cases, using this sort of the sharp edge of government's power to do that kind of implementation is sort of self-undermining because it causes people to, you know, maybe question the legitimacy of government decisions in the first place. And of course, you know, with the imprisonment part of that, this is not a time where we want to be filling up more jail cells and increasing the risk of community spread that way. So the main approach that law enforcement has taken around the state is I think what sheriffs refer to as an educational approach. So if there are very clear instances of violation, information is provided, there's a sort of strong word of encouragement there, but it's not as if anyone currently is being arrested or penalized in a very severe way for violating these rules. The idea is that law functions not only as that sharp stick, but also as a set of social norms, that it's a good idea if everybody tries to voluntarily adhere to this rule. Now, that works as long as there's a very high level of cohesion among people in our community's trust to tell them about what they should be doing in this emergency. The concern emerges when there are conflicting messages from political leaders, from law enforcement and public health officials about how people should be thinking about how to keep themselves safe. Our ability to actually rely on people's voluntary compliance with the rule diminishes. And so I think to preserve the ability of the government to not have to rely on these very punitive measures, which again may be self-undermining, it's necessary to have a sort of level of social cohesion in the messaging that I think we're really not familiar with having in our sort of very divided, divisive political context.
So with that idea of division, there are some police who are saying they won't enforce the new stay-at-home order. If they don't, then what happens? Is there anyone else who can enforce it?
Well, the first thing to note is that these statements of sheriffs around the state, there are not many sheriffs that have taken that position. And even among the sheriffs who have come out and said something critical about the Safer at Home order, not all of them have taken the position that they are not going to enforce it. And again, I think practically speaking, it was already the case that they weren't going around and sort of issuing a lot of citations for people not obeying the order. The practical effect of some sheriffs, and again, I should emphasize it's a very, very small minority of sheriffs saying that they're not going to enforce the order or the order is somehow illegitimate or unnecessary to abide by, could be that people in those particular localities are less likely to regard the order as legitimate and less likely to adhere to it. And so we begin to see cases increase, maybe deaths increase in those particular places. And if that's the case, I would suspect that there would be some recourse that the governor could exercise some authority to use the National Guard, for example, in an extreme case. Although I think, again, the governor doesn't want to have to do that. That's a very costly and unfortunate position for the governor to be in. So I think the hope here is that ultimately these communities, despite the sheriffs coming out and sort of making these statements, continue to adhere to social distancing voluntarily.
Well, and I don't think any of us want to see people dying.
Well, right. And I think the important thing to note is that sheriffs do not have the authority, as some of the sheriffs who have come out and said this have said, they don't have the authority to be the interpreter of the Constitution or the state statutes. They have to follow what the letter of the law is. Now, of course, they can contest those statutes. They, you know, can participate in lawsuits related to those statutes, but the courts are where we deal with those things. And of course, you know, there's a sort of history in the United States about the sort of political use of public health. And I think it's a concern that people have. Will political officials try to use public health measures to their own advantage? There's a case from 1900 where the city of San Francisco used a quarantine as a means of racial prejudice against the Chinese community. And so there is that sort of history there. But, you know, the fundamental fact is that the courts are where we deal with those issues. Sheriffs have a responsibility to not just sort of uphold the letter of the law, but I think also a sort of moral responsibility to emphasize sort of what is the kind of action that will keep a community safe. And it's, I think, disturbing to me as somebody who thinks a lot about public health to see a sort of a division among local civil servants on exactly what counts as an action that will keep people safe. And so my hope is that, you know, these incidents where we're seeing really sharp division among our elected officials and among even our sort of appointed officials on what is necessary to maintain, you know, public health and safety, that conflict is minor and is sort of a blip on the radar screen, and that ultimately we have a lot of convergence among the people that most of us trust to tell us, you know, what is necessary to sort of protect health and safety in this sort of very dangerous time. In the absence of that, and especially as this issue is made more conflictual, I think the ramifications for public health could be very dangerous.
Yeah. Well, Philip Rocco, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing some of your work.
Great to be with you, Joy. Stay well.
Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, where he teaches courses on American politics and the policymaking process. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR.